was all, it was very exciting stuff, very exciting stuff. So, yeah. So, the Brisbane days were good. I enjoyed Queensland, love Queensland. I enjoyed Brisbane. And again, we had a lot of time, a lot of fun there. And then, as you say, then it was, well, Russell Warner again on the phone. Well, laddie, you're going to take over the Canberra office. You know, well, again, that was a, you know, that was a big promotion. But I sort of, I hesitated. I mean, I didn't hesitate in terms of accepting, but I hesitated in my mind because of my previous experience in Canberra, which I had not enjoyed at all. You know, but I'd clearly learned a lot and matured a lot over the years between, and so, yeah, moved down to Canberra and became the chief report, political reporter for AM and PM in the gallery in Old Parliament House.
Now, how had the press gallery changed, if at all, since you were last there?
Not a lot. The you know, the personnel had changed to a degree. The actual gallery accommodation and everything else was pretty much as I'd remembered it. If there had been any improvements, they were very minor, to the point where you probably wouldn't have noticed them. The people that were there in those days, Laurie Oakes was there, Michelle Grattan, Paul Kelly, a guy called David Jensen was the head of the AAP Bureau, Australian Associated Press. Nikki Sava was there for the Sun Pictorial, Melbourne Sun Pictorial, quite a large number. And Alan Reid was still there, very much the doyen of the gallery then. Mungo McCullum, another one, you know. It was a good crew. It was a good crew of journos there. Tony Walker was there for the Melbourne Age. It was a good crew of journos. We all got on well. I got on well. I enjoyed the work. My offsider in current affairs, there were two of us, was a guy called Jeff Duncan, and he was a great guy. We had a lot of fun together. So all in all, it was a good experience. Yeah.
Did the had the technologies changed?
Not really. The news department had put in a decided to put to air a program called News Voice, which went to air from 5 until 5:15 each evening, and which was clearly an attempt by the news department to undermine Radio Current Affairs and the PM program. I mean, the ABC was a bit ludicrous in those days. I mean, you had these separate departments and never the twain shall meet. I think that's probably changed a fair bit now. But we were extremely competitive, and the two of us in Radio Current Affairs were in the same office space area as the news journos. We all got on very well. There was no problem there. But if a news guy had got a story that he didn't think we had, or vice versa, you know, it was, well, wait a minute, mate, we won't talk in here. We'll go out in the corridor and say, look, you know, we've got such and such here. We don't want these news blokes to get onto it as well. But the technologies were pretty much the same. Pretty much, yeah. No, and hadn't modified very much. We still had the big Nagras. We still cut-edited the tapes and, you know, sticking... cut edit the audio tapes, and it hadn't changed a hell of a lot.
I'd like to ask about any memories you have of particular prime ministers at this point, because I guess it's possible you would have met Gorton and McMahon. Would you have had any dealings with Gorton and McMahon?
Well, now, Not as prime ministers. McMahon, certainly, I do remember doing an interview with McMahon at the start of one of the parliamentary years, because he had become father of the house. And that was really for want of anyone else to interview in some respects. It wasn't a huge story, but they wanted something on, you know, the opening of parliament. So I thought, oh, well, we'll go and have a yarn to Billy McMahon. I can't really remember much about the interview. I don't think it was all that good, and certainly not all that memorable. John Gorton, again, certainly, you know, his prime ministership had been and gone. In fact, I think Gorton might well have been out of the parliament by the time I went back there. I think he'd gone. I did meet John Gorton, but many years later, when the National Party reopened the renovated John McEwen House Secretariat building in Barton, which was, I think, about 1996 or thereabouts. And John Gorton, who had opened the original building in 1967 when he was Prime Minister, he opened that building with McEwen. And John Gorton was there as a guest of honour at the opening of the redeveloped John McEwen House, but he was a very frail guy then, very frail guy. So, no, it didn't have a lot to do with either of those.
What about McEwen? Did you meet McEwen at all?
Yes, but not only when I was in the gallery in that late 60s period, 67. But I didn't meet him to talk to him. I just knew him and knew of him. I knew of him, and I knew as a young guy then, you knew very much to respect a bloke like that. And then by the time I came back, of course, McEwen had been and gone too.
Well, Fraser would have been the main one when you came back, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah. Fraser was the Prime Minister, and he was the key person to keep an eye on, get interviews with, go to press conferences with and things like that. You never really get to know a Prime Minister or in a hugely informal sense as a gallery journalist. There is that understandable barrier, I think. Fraser was probably better at maintaining that sort of a barrier than many other prime ministers. I don't think Fraser didn't like the media, didn't like the press, and he, the less he had to do with them in some respects, the better, I think, from his, I think that was his mentality about it. I remember doing one story for PM. We got onto the fact that Fraser had gone down to Melbourne in a VIP aircraft, supposedly for a meeting, an official meeting with business or industry. Anyway, the meeting didn't take place, and Fraser went to his tailor and got measured up for a suit. And we got onto this, and I rang the executive producer in Sydney to discuss it with him, and he said, yeah, let's go with it, let's run it. So we ran the story about the fact that Fraser's abusing taxpayers' money because he's using the RAAF VIP fleet to fly down to Melbourne and get measured up for a suit. It was a good story. Well, Fraser had three press secretaries. David Barnett was the senior press secretary. A guy called Alistair Drysdale was the middle guy, and then the third guy was a bloke who we all knew as Ocker Lloyd, who was a hell of a good guy. They operated in an interesting way. Barnett was very much the hierarchy. You didn't often get to see Barnett. Drysdale was the one you'd most usually see, and Drysdale was a if you like, the nice guy. Lloyd was the head kicker, and Lloyd spent most of his time down in the non-members bar, and if you'd done something that upset the PM, Drysdale would come in and say, oh, you shouldn't have done that, it wasn't fair, it wasn't right, this and that, blah, blah, blah. You go down to the bar, and Lloyd would absolutely climb into you, you don't know what you're talking about, this and that, quite abusive, almost trying to be intimidating. And then probably the next day, you'd get the call from, well, the summons from Barnett, would you come up and see him? So you'd go and see David, and David would give you a bit of a lecture about the fact that, you've got to be responsible as a journalist, you've got to realise that you shouldn't be doing anything that destabilises the government and all this sort of rubbish. And that treatment happened a few times, but particularly after that occasion, yeah.
How would you respond to that?
With Lloyd, you'd just say, oh, shut up, Ocker, it's your bloody shout, buy me a beer, and he'd still carry on, but he didn't take much notice of that. You'd give Barnett a bit more respect, but you'd take no notice of him. And it wasn't only on the government side. I remember doing an interview with Bill Hayden, which his office, where he got quite upset about. I can't remember exactly what it was about, but I know there was... pretty strong complaint to head office about the fact that I was clearly biased in the way I approached him and this and that and everything else. And Russell Warner called me up one day and said, "Laddie, you're stirring the possums down there." I said, "Oh, what do you mean?" He said, "Well, you've got to be doing the job right because I'm getting complaints about you from both sides."
Very good.
You've got to be a bit thick-skinned, you know. They doesn't matter which side of politics it is, they will try and protect their interests very astutely and straightforwardly. You've just got to, you know, be a bit thick-skinned about it all.
Anything else you'd like to say about the gallery
there? About the gallery days? Oh, no. They were a lot of fun. The old members bar in old Parliament House was a very memorable place because everybody went there. Politicians, occasionally you get senior ministers even drop in for a beer, but the journos got down there, the press secs, backbenchers across party lines, and the non-members bar stayed open, I think, for 2 hours after the last house rose. Well, if the Senate was sitting till 3 o'clock in the morning, you could still be on the Terps at five, you know. But it was a very convivial atmosphere. Everybody sort of relaxed and enjoyed it. Once you're down in the non-members, apart from when you're getting a lecture from Lloyd, really the serious part of politics was over. Although you'd always keep your ear open for a bit of a lead or something that you could follow up, or some little tidbit that somebody drops that perhaps they shouldn't have done, a bit of an indiscretion about something gives you a lead here and there, you know. So everybody had to be on that, you know. Everybody was relaxed and convivial and social, but at the same time, on the alert. The gallery was great, and it was a good experience for me, which I guess would probably lead you on to your question about, well, how did I then leave and join Peter Nixon?
Yes.
And that was, frankly, more economic than anything else.
Okay.
A senior A reporter, senior A grade, which is what I was on in the gallery, but paid all right, there was no problem there. But a senior private secretary for a cabinet minister paid quite a bit more, probably $15,000 a year more than what you were getting as a journo, which in those days was quite a lot of money. And this job, again, was an advertised position for principal private secretary, they used to call them, to the Minister for Transport, who happened to be Peter Nixon, who I knew Nixon because Nixon had made quite a name for himself bashing the ABC, which he started doing back in the Whitlam government days, bashing them as being full of socialists and communists and biased and this and that and everything else. And he got quite a reputation for himself of doing that, a bit of a hard man of politics. But I was hesitant to apply because I thought, you know, these sort of positions usually went to senior people from within the department. My wife was the one who said, look, you know, get the application in and you never know if you never try. So I applied. And a couple of weeks later, I get this call from his office, you know, would you come down and see the minister? So I just went down. I sort of thought to myself, gee, what have I done wrong? You know, I've done anything. I was sort of half expecting Nixon to sort of get into me about being with the ABC, you know, because I filed some story on him, but I couldn't sort of think of anything I'd done to upset him. Anyway, I walked in there and he basically just said, oh, you know, you've applied for this job. It sort of came into focus and I said, yes. And he said, are you a member of any political party? And I said, no, I'm not. But if that's a prerequisite of the job, I'd consider it. No, he said, no, I don't want any member I wouldn't mind if you're a member of the Labour Party, but I don't want anybody who's a member of the National Country Party, because I want people to give me objective advice, not sycophantic advice out of the branches. I sort of thought about that. Yeah. And then he said, "You're a member of the AJA, Australian Journalists Association." I said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "Well, I want you to keep that." I didn't quite know. Well, I didn't ask him, but I didn't quite see what the point was there. But obviously, he wanted, if he was to employ me, he wanted to be able to, if the necessity arose, to be able to say that his press secretary was a member of the union. Mm-hmm. He said, "Oh, you'll have to go down and see the head of the department." There's a guy called Holton, which I did, and Charles Holton, I think. He was an interesting bloke. He gave me one of these typical sort of public service bureaucratic based sort of IQ type tests, you know, yeah, very strange sort of questions and things like that. Anyway, a couple of weeks later, Nixon said, "Look, okay, yep, you know, you've got the job." So that's how that started. And, you know, I mean, actually, I couldn't have worked for a better minister than Nixon, in that he was a great teacher. You talk about McEwen, he had learnt from McEwen. McEwen had taught him basically everything he knew about politics. And he was a head-kicking politician, Nixon was. He was as tough as nails. He was also extremely perceptive. He could smell a problem coming before it even got over the horizon, you know, and to have that perspective, that ability, it's very handy in politics. And a lot of that rubbed off on me, I think, and I thoroughly enjoyed working with Nixon because we had a lot of fun together. He had a great sense of humour. But by gee, when he wanted to put the boot in, you know, he wasn't backwards in coming forwards with it. We had some tough times, of course. He was Minister for Transport when I first went there. Then Ian Sinclair got accused of forging his father's signature and had to stand down for the time being as the Minister for Primary Industry and the Deputy Leader of the Country Party. Nixon was appointed as Minister for Primary Industry, as well as, for the time being, holding the transport portfolio. Well, that put a hell of a lot of pressure on us. And the staff in those days, I think there were six of us altogether in a ministerial office. These days, I think they have 20 or something. You know.
And where was the office?
Next to the Treasurer's office. So if you walk down the government side, which is what the left-hand side, near the front car park side of from King's Hall, of the corridors of King's Hall, and then down the stairs, and then there was a little sort of corridor. It was actually almost underneath the PM's office.
Okay.
A bit hard to explain, but they had the Treasurer's office at the end, and then Nixon had an office here. Opposite him was Eric Robinson, the Liberal from Queensland, and next to him Jim Killen, and then Peter Nixon here. Pretty small office, you know, nothing too luxurious. I mean, his office was quite good, but the staff accommodation was very tight indeed. And each minister sort of structured their personal staff in different ways. Peter Nixon, I think he had a good system going. He had a girl called Thea McCabe, a lady called Thea McCabe, who was his cabinet secretary, and she handled all the cabinet documents. I wouldn't cite a cabinet document unless I needed to. It was a need-to-know basis. Nixon imposed that because he didn't want to compromise me in the context of my talking to the press and being asked a question about a cabinet minute, which, you know, if I had seen and I had to tell a direct lie and say, no, I didn't know about it. He was quite meticulous in those areas. Then he had a diary secretary and two stenographers, so that's plus me. So one, Thea, diary secretary, two outers, and me. So that's five of us. And later on, he got an extra one. So there was five or six, that was it. And he had this system where under his desk he had a bell, which would buzz out in the office area, and if it was one buzz, he wanted to dictate a letter or something, a stenographer would go in there. Two buzzers would get Thea McCabe in there with the cabinet papers. Three buzzers would get me in there as the principal private secretary. Mm-hmm. All sounds very primitive these days, doesn't it? But it actually worked very well.
It sounds very efficient.
Yeah, it worked very well.
And what were your duties as senior private secretary?
Well, speech writing, press release writing, and liaising with the press, and then liaising with industry organisations and lobbyists and things like that. They were mainly it. I did quite a few overseas trips with him, but Nixon used to think that speeches and press releases were sort of the key things that needed to be done well, and he didn't like depending on departmental drafts. He wanted his speeches. I mean, an industry speech, for instance, would usually originate out of the department, and in typical public service sort of style and fashion, they were drab, they were boring, they were statistically accurate and everything else, but He wanted the stuff taken out of that was necessary, and he wanted the politics put in on top of it. That was very much my job in that regard. It was quite interesting. One of the first speeches he gave that I helped to supervise was to a shipping conference, and we got the draft from the department, and it was probably went about half an hour, and I read the thing and I rang a couple of departmental people and said, look, does this really need to get in there? And, oh, yes, look, the industry needs to be reassured about this and they should know about that and blah, blah, blah. So I thought, well, bugger me, there's not much I can take out of this. And I tightened it a bit here and there. And he gave the speech, and coming back, he said, well, what do you think of that? And I said, well, it was all right. And he said, well, what do you mean? You wrote it. And I said, well, it was really the departmental draft. And he said, well, what are you saying? I said, well, it was too long and it was turgid and it was boring. And he said, well, that's what I'm paying you for. What would you have done with it? And I said, well, for a start, I've always believed that if you can't say something in 10 minutes, you shouldn't even be up on the stage. And he sort of smiled at that. And he said, okay. So what do you propose to do? And I said, well, I'll make one deal with you here and now. You will never get a draft speech from me that runs longer than 15 minutes. All right, he said, that sounds all right. And but he also, in saying all of that, gave me a lot more confidence about cutting, upsetting some of the departmental guys a bit, but really cutting into departmental drafts and getting a lot more political about what we were doing. But, the most memorable thing with Peter Nixon, I guess, was the meat scandal. Which was a horrifying experience where this was what, about 1980, 80, 82, 81, might have been late 81, 82. Bang, 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 the three buzzers there. I walked into his office and he was sitting there and he was as white as a sheet. Then I just said to him, Christ Minister, are you okay? What's wrong? And he said, read this. He'd got a cable from the United States Department of Agriculture, through from the Bureau of Animal Health, which was attached to the DPI, which confirmed that they had found suspected horse meat in shipments of Australian chilled beef packs out of a works called Profreeze in Victoria. And I mean, Nixon knew exactly what this meant. This was devastating stuff. I mean, the entire Australian export beef trade was absolutely, under the gun at this point. And it got worse because further tests in America confirmed that not only was the horse meat in it, it was kangaroo meat in it too. And I mean, it became known as the meat scandal. It was a huge, rolling, developing crisis. And the government ended up setting up a royal commission. Fraser sent Nixon overseas immediately. Once we got everything in place, we tightened the laws and the regulations for this and that and everything else. We changed the locking system on the back of freezer trucks and on the all sorts of things, the way meat packs were marked. Got all that locked down, and then he took me with him, and we flew direct to, out of Canberra, direct to Denver, Colorado, where we met with the American Cattlemen's Association. Then we went on to Washington. We had rounds of talks with secretaries of agriculture and all sorts of other people. We went on to the UK, and likewise there with government officials, on to Brussels for the with the European Union people, back to the UK, then over the North Pole down to Tokyo for the Japanese government, and across to Seoul with the South Koreans, and back to Australia. We worked out we were actually in the air more time than we were on the ground. We were away for a total of 9 days, and it was just go, go, go. Then the Royal Commission report came down, and the commissioner had found that that the minister had not acted adequately on an earlier report known as the Kelly Report, being done by a former Liberal South Australian member, Bert Kelly, into the Australia's Meat Inspection Services. And Bert Kelly had questioned, the whole idea of the Kelly exercise was to see whether we could get a uniform national system of meat inspection as opposed to separate Commonwealth and state ones. And Kelly had raised unspecified allegations of corruption in the meat industry. Well, that sort of thing happened all the time. Nixon referred it to the Bureau of Animal Health, and that was that. Nothing further emanated. Well, the Royal Commissioner had seized on that to say that the minister hadn't acted adequately on that report. Nixon felt that, well, that's it. That's the end of the line. I've got to resign. And he called me into the office on the Sunday. He got the report on the Friday, flew home. He rang me on Friday night and said, you better get yourself ready to come in the office on Sunday. I'll ring you Sunday morning. Rang me on the Sunday morning. And I got into the office. He said, I want you to draft me a letter of resignation. And I said, look, you know, surely it doesn't have to come to this, does it? He said, Paul, don't argue with me. Just go and do it. So I went out and started doing it. And then Doug Anthony turned up. He'd flown down from Woolloombar. And the two of them sat there for the Sunday afternoon. I think they probably got rid of most of a bottle of scotch, if not all of it. And then Doug left, with quite a twinkle in his eye and a bit of a smile on his face, and said, I think Peter might have a few changes on that letter, Paul. You better go in and see him. And the change was... The change was basically that instead of saying I therefore tender my resignation, the change was I therefore place my future in your hands. In other words, Anthony, it was basically his idea, Anthony's idea, was saying to Malcolm Fraser, well, it's on your head, and if you want to sack this minister, you try and sack him, but by Christ, you'll have a fight with the Country Party if you do. As it turned out, Fraser had no intention of sacking Nixon. He had gone through the Royal Commission report quite meticulously. He called in up to the lodge, myself, Doug Anthony's senior secretary, a bloke called Barry Virtue, a couple of senior people from his own department, his own principal private secretary, who was David Budd, the press secretary, David Barnett. So a small squad of us to pour over all the things to pull together what, if you like, a defensive position. And Fraser got up in the Parliament, and he lambasted the Royal Commissioner, who was a guy called Woodward, in no uncertain terms, basically for being highly selective in the way he chose to interpret the evidence. That was quite an interesting exercise, but by God, I wouldn't want to live through that again.
You used the word horrendous.
Oh, it was horrendous. Mm-hmm. It was horrendous. Absolutely horrendous. And, you know, those are the things that I suppose you basically, it's just adrenaline that drives you, because there's very little sleep. You're working late, late, late into the night, and from virtually the crack of dawn, and it's just constant gathering and maintaining all the evidence that you can get to make sure you're in a position to be able to rapidly defend you, give your minister the material he needs to defend himself against a barrage of questions at question time, followed by a censure motion against him and all the rest of it. You've just got to be there and on top of it all, so that if somebody bangs a question or puts an allegation to him that you can refute, and you know you can, you've got to have that paper there, bang, give it to the minister, get it out to him, you know. So, yeah, we got over that. A lot of people suggested, because that happened by the time the Royal Commission report came out, you know, it was 82, and then Fraser called the election in 83. Nixon decided to retire at that election, and quite a few people speculated that he was retiring at that point because he'd been so burned by the Royal Commission. In fact, he wasn't retiring because of that. It's quite interesting. I didn't know at the time, but subsequently found out that he had actually told Fraser and Anthony at the election in 70... There was an election in either 78 or 79. But at that time, that election, he'd told them both that that was going to be his last. He wanted to retire at the following election, which happened to be 1980. And they both persuaded him in 1980 not to go then. And by 1983, he had absolutely determined that he was going to go. And he got his announcement out just before Fraser. He sensed that Fraser was on the verge of announcing an election in March 83. So he announced in about February that he wouldn't be contesting the election. And the interesting thing is, Ian Sinclair subsequently told me that had Peter Nixon decided to stay on, he, Sinclair, would have not contested 83. But Sinclair, of course, went on to stay in there for many years more.
Yes, yes.
Interesting quirks of politics.
Now, you've mentioned that you had to be on top of the politics in this position. Does that mean you were now kind of philosophically, politically allied or with the Country Party, National
Party?
Yeah,
in a way, I think, well, yes, you know, I enjoyed the Country Party. I wasn't a member of it. I had not been a member of any political party and still wasn't. But, I mean, I'd obviously come from conservative-minded origins, if you like, even way back in England. I had now was now well associated with. I mean, I was married into a country family. My wife's family, her mum and dad, were in Orange, and the rest of her family were principally in Coonabarabran and also in Warialda. So very much country family, country people. She was a country girl. I had spent time in Wagga. In the country, I enjoyed the country. I was regarding myself far more as a country Australian than a city Australian. I just didn't like living in cities. Canberra was okay because it was really a country town. So it was, yeah, philosophically, I think my natural leaning was towards the Country Party because of what it was representing, country people, country interests, as opposed to the Liberals.
And going back a bit to Whitlam, did you have a reaction to the dismissal of Whitlam? I didn't ask that.
No, not really, other than the fact that, you had Clive Speed on the phone, the executive producer of PM, saying he's been dismissed, get out there and get what you can. I didn't have much time to have much of a reaction. I was trying to find other people's reaction. The lead-up to it, while the actual dismissal, came as a huge sort of shock and surprise to everybody. In some respects, it shouldn't have done, because the lead up to the dismissal had been going on for quite some time. The to-ing and fro-ing vis-a-vis the Wiley Fancher and the funny money, the loans affair, and all of this sort of stuff. So I didn't. I must say that after the election, when you saw the results of the 75 election, it seemed to me that election result justified the means, absolutely. I mean, it was an overwhelming victory for Fraser and the coalition, and a complete repudiation of Whitlam. So, I mean, bleat as he may, and as he did, about the fact that the Constitution had been torn up and, nothing will save the Governor-General and all this sort of business, well, I mean, I just don't think that stands up when you look at the 70, December 75 election result, and indeed the following election, which again was resoundingly won by the coalition. And of course, many people would say now, in hindsight, that those two elections, when Fraser had control of both houses, were the period when he squandered his opportunity, particularly to crack down on trade unions. And you know, people look back on the Fraser government basically these days and saying, well, it was a total failure, he didn't do anything. And you know, I can understand why to some degree, because it did seem to be a disappointment. I've spoken to Fraser about it since, and Fraser, needless to say, of course, will argue to the contrary, saying that they did actually do most of what they intended to do, you know, establishing the Industrial Relations Bureau, various other things, but just never seemed to... The big seeming failure, I think, to the majority of people who remember back at that time, I mean, there was huge industrial unrest going on under Whitlam, and Fraser was going to crack down on that, and he just never seemed to do so.
Now, during the period with Peter Nixon, you mentioned how allegations were made against Ian Sinclair regarding his signature on his father's will. How did that affect the party? Were you close enough to the party in general to know how the impact?
Oh, well, in terms of the parliamentary party, it was devastating. Here was the third most senior man in the party. The second most senior man in the party, and the third most senior man in the government, third or fourth most senior man in the government.